Teach you today about naturalness. And this is a concept that's been driving research in particle physics and phenomenology, at least for a long time, basically since the advent of the Standard Model in the 70s. It's given us a lot of interesting things. For example, it's given us Technicolor, it gave us SUSY, and with SUSY came gauge coupling unification. It's given us large and warped extra dimensions and little Higgs theories. Now, I don't want to talk very much or at all today about whether this is a good guiding principle, whether this is the principle that we should be using to guide our research. I just want to kind of give you an overview of my research and how it relates to naturalness, kind of like a trajectory of my career in physics so far. I'd like to start with the concept of naturalness in supersymmetry. And I think we all know that supersymmetry is good because it solves the gauge hierarchy problem. There's quadratic divergences in loop corrections to the Higgs mass that make it finely tuned. And what SUSY does is it gives us a good reason to expect there to be new particles with couplings related by symmetry to the Standard Model particle couplings to the Higgs. And these can naturally cancel off these quadratic divergences, giving you a theory that's natural. So it solves the hierarchy problem. One of the good things about SUSY, gives us gauge coupling unification, which is, you know, a very beautiful consequence. It also gives us a stable LSP, so a dark matter candidate. And this comes from just imposing an R parity, keeps the proton stable, and also gives us dark matter. And it also sort of gives us electroweak symmetry breaking for free, kind of, right? Because it comes from, you can think of it as being radiatively generated by running masses down from high scales down to low scales, generating a negative mass spread for the Higgs. But unfortunately for SUSY and unfortunately for us, we didn't see the Higgs at LEP. So there's a lower bound in the Higgs mass of 115 JeV, and that's not so good for SUSY because there's a constraint that the tree-level Higgs mass, that relates the tree-level Higgs mass to the Z mass, and you can think of loop corrections to this, which might allow us to push it above the LEP limit. Unfortunately, there are also corrections to the bare mass squared of the Higgs that go like the log of the cutoff. So you've cancelled off the quadratic divergence, but you still have a log divergent term in there. So in order to get a Higgs that's heavier than the LEP bound, we want a heavy stop. We want a large log here. We want a stop of around 500 JeV. But the larger the stop mass, the larger the log divergent contribution to the Higgs mass. So there's basically a tension here. You want a heavy stop to get the Higgs above the LEP limit, but the heavier the stop is, the larger the fine-tuning in the theory. In fact, this is actually the worst thing that you can have, because the fine-tuning is proportional to the top stop mass squared, and the Higgs mass, the physical Higgs mass, is only logarithmic in the stop mass squared. So with 500 JeV stops, we can get above the LEP limit, but unfortunately, we have to live with a percent level fine-tuning. This is what's known as a little hierarchy in SUSY. How can you solve this issue? Well, one solution is to increase the tree-level Higgs mass. And there are various ways in which you can do this, one of which is to go from just the minimal supersymmetric Standard Model to the next to minimal. You add a singlet to the MSSM with this superpotential term here, and it gives additional contributions to the Higgs quartic that can push up the tree-level Higgs mass. And the RGE for this, I guess, Yukawa coupling goes like this. It has positive contributions coming from itself and top loops, and it has negative contributions coming from the gauge couplings. So you are not free to push the value of this coupling up at the electroweak scale as high as you want, because it runs up in the UV, so eventually it's going to hit a Landau pole. So if you impose perturbativity to the cutoff, all you can get is a modest enhancement to the Higgs mass bound of about 150 GeV.
If you increase the Higgs mass above 600 GeV, then you get a Landau pole at 2 TeV.
Oh, you're saying that that would be okay with you?
Well, so you can't have a Higgs mass 600 GeV.
So I'm going to tell you about a way in which you can get a large Higgs mass without without spoiling the good things about SUSY, for example, gauge coupling unification at the dot scale.
So you avoid the Higgs Landau pole?
Yes, by UV completing into an infrared free theory. I'm going to talk a bit more.
Sorry, by what?
UV completing into an IR free theory. So
how can we push this tree level mass up even further? Well, one way you can think about doing this is adding to the standard model or to the MSSM 5+5 bars, right? 5+5 bars are under the standard model gauge groups will make these gauge groups stronger, and so it'll give you some more room as to how high you can push up lambda. Unfortunately, these are just the strong and electroweak. The electroweak and hypercharged gauge couplings, which are still very weak for a huge range of the running. So you can't really get that much enhancement from doing that. So what else can we do? Well, we can add to this another gauge coupling, which actually gets strong. And that hopefully will allow us to push up the value of lambda at the electroweak scale even further. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to add some strong SUN gauge symmetry, and I'm going to add the following field content under that symmetry. These fields chi are charged under both the standard model and the new SUN gauge symmetry. And there's also some additional fields that I haven't showed you here that are basically singlets under the standard model and are only charged under the new gauge symmetry. So we can write down this the superpotential at some high scale. There are Yukawa couplings between the Higgs up and Higgs down with these new fields X and these fields phi. There's a mass term for the X's and the X bars. And there's also this W mass, which is a term that will give masses to all the unwanted mesons and baryons in the theory after I S-confine. So the details are kind of unimportant. So when I run down in energy, as I reach the scale of mx, I can integrate out these x's and x bars, and I generate this kind of term in a superpotential. And then if I run down even further, so now I've integrated out some of the flavors, basically five flavors of this SUN gauge symmetry, of this SU4 gauge symmetry, and so it S-confines. It gets strong in the infrared. And the low energy effective theory contains a term that looks like what you get in the NMSSM with some coefficient that you can get by naive dimensional analysis up to an order one coefficient up here. A linear term for the S that breaks the Petrequin symmetry and that keeps the axion light. These mass terms for the mesons and baryons in the theory, and of course the dynamical superpotential, as Seibert told us, for the mesons and baryons, which are the low energy degrees of freedom.
The axion multiplet from
it's a singlet. It's a gauge singlet.
But is it effective? Is it composite or is
it? It's composite. Yeah, it's the theory S confines these things as a composite of these fields.
What is it? A composite of?
Of these five fields.
The scalar fields.
Yes. These are chiral superfields.
Sorry.
Chiral superfields? Yeah. So S is now a gauge singlet chiral superfield.
So you're making H composite from scalar fields. It's been zero fields.
No, that's fine. It's a supermodel.
You can't do that. They have to be fermions.
Phi includes everything, fermions, and it's a chiral superfield.
It's a
supersymmetry.
It's a supersymmetric theory. Yeah, I don't want to. So my aim here is to take away the bad things about SUSY, which is basically the tension between pushing up the Higgs mass and fine tuning, and keep all the good things about it. Keep gauge coupling unification. Keep the solution of the hierarchy, the gauge hierarchy problem in this issue.
Well, sorry to ask a question. The latest results from Atkins CMS is that they've excluded squawks and gorillas up to, say, 800 GeV. So, what are the masses of these supersymmetric particles that make up the composites?
So, unfortunately, these limits from Atlas and CMS are not very robust because they're only true under the assumption that you have M supra at the high scale. So, you take away that constraint, you take away universal M halves and M zeros, and you're left with no constraint.
Yeah, but you have to have a model so you can make a prediction. You have to constrain it somehow. Right?
So I think the interesting phenomenology in this model is not to do with how heavy the squats and gluinos are. It's actually to do with some light baryon states, which I'm not really going to have time to talk about over here. But yeah, there is some interesting phenomenology, and you're right, it's important to make a prediction. But I don't think I can apply those SUSY constraints that come from CMS and Atlas to this model as it stands. But there are only constraints in a very limited set of high-energy, UV conditions.
One way to get rid of the hierarchy problem is not to have a Higgs particle.
Sorry?
I feel that we should leave that discussion to
talk. I will shut up for a while.
When you write HU and HD, are those two different Higgses, or are they just two states of the same?
They're just the normal Higgs of the nervous system. The Higgs outputs in the inner system. Everything else is the same. The thing is, I don't want to ruin gauge coupling unification. So I don't want to make these things charged, or I don't want any new fields that are charged on both the new, the strongly coupled gauge symmetry and this one. Right? Okay, so let me just give you a brief summary of what happens next. You can use cycle duality to estimate the size of the Yukawas at the strong coupling scale, and then you can run down to the weak scale. And you find that you can get a Higgs mass of anywhere between 260 and 350 GeV. Of course, all these things are modular order one constants that I don't have any information about, as I said in the previous slide. Gauge coupling unification still works, but it's manifest because I'm only adding 5+5 bars. If you look at my previous slide, these are basically, you know, a doublet and a triplet. They're 5+5 bars. Okay, so let me go back to my previous slide. So I've sort of solved the little hierarchy problem here, but at what cost, right? There's some kind of Baroque new particle sector that I've had to add in order to do this. There's all sorts of mesons and baryons that I have to make heavy by adding singlets. I actually end up adding 10 flavors of SU4. This theory is asymptotically free in the UV.
Sure, fine.
Right, so I've chosen this strong gauge symmetry in order to make things kind of more or less calculated.
It condenses somewhere in between, right?
It condenses somewhere in between.
This is, I mean, the whole thrust of SUSY was to get rid of as much as possible from strong interaction friction.
So these MGA estimates basically parameterize my ignorance about that condensation process. Okay, so
I've solved it, but at what cost? I was trying to solve a problem of aesthetics, and my solution is not all that aesthetically pleasing. And in my experience, at least, all the different ways that people have tried to solve this little hierarchy problem, you end up running into other problems that you have to work really hard to get around. And so it's not clear what the value of doing this is. Okay, so that's my... That's my summary on the little hierarchy problem in SUSY. I'd like to go on to a problem of hierarchies and naturalness that I think can be tackled in a much more aesthetically pleasing way.
Unification. Does that just means the crossing of all the coupling constants?
At MGUT.
But it doesn't mean you actually have a particular theory of unification?
I don't have a theory of unification. I don't think there's a reason why this theory can't be unified in the same way the MSSM is unified. So I'm just adding singlets on the standard model and 5+5 balls. This
problem of naturalness is a cosmological problem, and it's a problem of naturalness in slow roll inflation. So I don't think for this audience I need to emphasize all the problems that inflation solves. The only thing is that the simplest field theory implementation, that of a slowly rolling scalar field, kind of has a fine-tuning in it already. So you're trying to solve some issues of fine-tuning, and you substitute that with another fine-tuning, which is not so so satisfactory. So it would be really nice if there was a way in which you could have these slow roll parameters be small naturally for some other reason in your theory.
I guess that doesn't fall into my simplest field theory implementation, right? I don't think it's fine-tuned. I don't know very much about chaotic inflation.
It's certainly you can have a slow roll there, right? It's just phi squared, m squared, phi squared potential. I
mean, what enforces that the slow roll parameter is the small?
Well, there's a small mass. Right? I mean, okay. Mass is small.
So that's what I call
compared to the Planck scale, right? I mean, it's 10 to the 11 GeV. Okay.
Is there any natural way that mass is enforced to be small?
What's natural?
Okay, that's a question I didn't want to get into in this talk. But anyway, okay. So for a long time, people were really excited about brain inflation because it seemed like there was a natural way to get this this really flat slow roll potential, right? If I have two brains that act like point particles in n extra dimensions, I can write down naively the Newtonian potential. It looks like this. And when the brains are very far apart, this term is negligible, and so the potential is really, 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 really flat. And then at some point, as the brains get close together, this term kicks in, and you feel the attractive force between the brains. So everything looks really great, but there are two big issues with this naive argument. Okay, the first one is, suppose I just take this potential, slow-roll potential, and I look at the kinetic term for the distance between the brains. The distance between the brains is what's going to turn out to be my inflaton. Sorry, there's something I didn't mention. So in order to sample this really flat potential, this really flat region of the potential, you want the brains to be able to get far enough away from each other and not hit the edges of your space, basically. So, and that seems like it would be very feasible, right? You can choose the size of your space and the tension between your brains as such that you can have a large order of magnitude between the two scales, and so you can get the brains far enough apart in order to sample this flat region. But now I'm going to tell you that that's no longer true. So I'm going to canonically normalize to get my inflaton field. So that's how I define my inflaton field. And if I compute eta with this potential and these inflaton fields, I find that eta is actually completely independent of all dimensionful quantities. It's just dependent on this, what I call shape function, it doesn't have any dimensionful parameters in it, which means that I can't take any hierarchies between dimensionful parameters in my theory in order to naturally get a small eta. That's one issue. The second one is that we know that in order to have
Is it like a Randall-Sandrin model?
No, it's not. Randall-Sandrin is going to be an exception to my arguments, but what I'm going to end up doing is looking at a codimension to brain inflation model.
And what is the ambient space that you said it can't hit the boundary? I didn't quite understand it.
So you have a compact. You need your extra dimensions to be compactified, right? So my initial naive question is, can I get my brains far enough away so that they can sample the flat region without getting to the edge of my space?
So is there enough space in this extra dimensions to get the brains as far as
exactly.
The brain? Is that the question?
That was my question, yeah. It's a very naive way of looking at it, but you'll see that it actually gives you some physical insight. Okay. So I know that my extra dimensions have to be compactified, right? And for n flat compact extra dimensions, I can write down the Poisson equation due to a brain sitting at the origin everywhere else in the space. Now you know that for compactified extra dimensions, this is inconsistent, right? If I integrate this over the total volume of the space, this is a total derivative, so integrate to zero. This side is not going to integrate to zero.
Now, these people, Kutcher et al., told us that in order to make this Poisson equation consistent in a closed space, you need to add this this volume subtraction term. And they say that this emerges naturally from the curvature of space-time. It makes it look really mysterious, but now if you look, if you integrate over the total space, you get something that's actually consistent. Now, I'm going to argue that this volume subtraction is not actually some large mysterious thing. It just comes from the fact that when you compute the low-energy effective theory after integrating out all the KK modes, you can't integrate out your zero mode from your theory. And it's this volume subtraction that actually prevents you from being able to do that. In order to do that, let me just do an example that people might be a bit more familiar with. The example of a point mass on an N-torus. Okay? So, say I Fourier transform my Poisson equation in order to solve this problem. And I see that for all k, all n not equal to zero, for all non-zero modes, I can solve for the Fourier transform of my Poisson, I can solve for phi tilde and integrate these modes out of my theory. But for the zero mode now, this equation is inconsistent, and I need to make sure there's a way that I add something, basically, that tells me that for the zero mode, that gives me, no information about the zero mode. So for n equals zero now, this gives me 0 equals 0. That tells me that I have to leave the zero mode in my effective theory, and that's what's going to give rise to de Sitter expansion of my space. Right? It's going to give me time dependence, the zero mode. So if you just look at this modification here, this corresponds exactly in Fourier transform this. This corresponds exactly to this 1 over ln subtraction. Okay, so the moral of the story is when you compute a Green's function from a low energy effective theory standpoint, you don't integrate out your zero mode. It's very, very intuitive. Okay, so what does this do to you? If I take my modified Poisson equation and I factorize out all dimensionable quantities the way I did before, I find this equation. And if I look at this away from all the sources, I can put a limit on this dimensionless shape function that determines my slow roll parameter eta. And the way I minimize this is I distribute this derivative evenly in all dimensions, and that gives me a hard upper limit on eta that's a function of the total number of brains in my space and the total number of extra dimensions, both of which are order one quantities. Okay? So if you believe Kutcher et al., and I've sort of tried to give you an intuitive explanation for this this volume subtraction term, it's the presence of this volume subtraction term that gives you this hard upper limit on eta from extra dimensions.
So I didn't quite understand, but what if the charges of all the brains cancel out? Won't that volume term go away?
These brains are purely gravitational. That's all I'm talking about. They don't have any other charge.
So the inflation is what is like the distance between
the distance between the brains. That's what
and
the original
the heating is what?
The brains collide and annihilate. I don't know.
Wow.
I mean,
they collide.
They need to have something that stops inflation. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to make any very big statements.
It sounds
about
like a lot more important thing than them being moved away from each other and then interacting.
It is an interesting question, but it's not one that I'm going to tackle here. Okay. So this kind of tells you the brain inflation is dead, but it's not.
If there are no force, or is there an attractive force?
Gravity.
But to collide two points attracted by gravity, you have to have like zero angular momentum, otherwise they will go into miss each other and keep going.
Well, I can say that they come arbitrarily slowly together.
Right, but then that's a fine tuning because
you have to send
one onto the
okay.
top of the
that's
other.
That's not the fine tuning problem that I'm trying to solve here, so maybe we should leave that to discussion after, after the talk. I'm trying to solve one fine tuning problem, and you're coming up with others that I should be solving. Okay, so is brain inflation dead? No, for two reasons. First of all, I've used
all my arguments here took into account just the naive Newtonian potential between the brains. And we know that that's not the whole story in a few cases. For example, in co-dimension 1, RS, where you have warpings, you need to solve the Einstein's equations in order to tell you what the dynamics is for the brain. You can't use Newtonian potential. Another example is co-dimension 2, and that's the one I'm going to be concentrating on here. In co-dimension 2, gravity is kind of weird. You don't have a Newtonian potential there either. Let me just review some work done in the 60s, I guess, by these people. If I look at a point mass in 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, I can write down the line element. You know that 2 spatial dimensions is conformal to flat space. And the only non-trivial component of the Einstein's equation looks like this. And I can solve this to obtain what this function omega is. And if I go to polar coordinates, I can substitute omega back into this equation. And I obtain this with after I've made a coordinate redefinition, I see looks exactly like flat space, right? But with a restriction on the theta angle of my polar coordinate. So in other words, if I put a point mass in 2D gravity at some point, it's going to cut out some deficit angle, which is proportional to its mass. And these two sides of the space get identified, and so you end up with a conical space with the mass at its apex. This conical space is flat everywhere, apart from at the position of the mass. And now if I put another mass in this 2 plus 1D space, it's going to cut at its own deficit angle, end up on its own conical space. And these two masses are not going to interact gravitationally. The gravitational potential between the two masses is exactly zero in 2 plus 1D gravity. So this gives us some hope, right? We know that from Kachu et al.'s argument that if you have any gravitational potential between two brains, that gives rise to an inflationary potential that's too steep to be natural. Yeah? But in 2 plus 1D gravity, you can get rid of, you have zero gravitational potential between point sources. In order to make this more realistic, we're going to think about 6 dimensions and we're going to compactify 2 of them eventually, and 3 brains in 6 dimensions. Again, these are co-dimension 2 objects, so you'd expect the behavior to be the same, qualitatively the same in the 2 extra dimensions as the case of point masses in 2 plus 1D gravity. Okay? So let me try and reproduce the exact result that I showed you in 2 plus 1D that was carried out by Deezer, Jakiv, and all these people. Let me try and reproduce that perturbatively using 3 brain sources in 6 dimensions. Hopefully this will give us some insight. I mean, it all looks very magical from the 2 plus 1D perspective. I want to get some kind of field particle physicist insight for what's going on here. So I can write down the Einstein-Hilbert action for the brains, where this source term is, it looks like this. It's only non-zero along the dimensions, the directions where we have the brain, and it's zero in all the other directions. I can compute the potential between the brains by inverting the quadratic part of the Lagrangian in some gauge. I choose the Donda gauge. And I find when I compute this potential, I get exactly zero, as you expect from the exact calculation in 2 plus 1D. Perturbations around the
small
back, the metric. I'll tell you over here. Okay. So this still seems a little mysterious. It seems to be just a kind of a property of exactly what dimension this was and exactly what dimension this was, and for D minus the total number of dimensions minus the extra dimensions equals 2, you get a cancellation. What does this look like actually from the 4D effective theory? What's giving rise to this cancellation? So I can figure this out by reparameterizing the metric perturbations in this way. I have 6 different morphisms that I need to gauge away, and I choose this gauge. And it's kind of funny, this one. But the reason I choose it is because in this gauge, all the fields become decoupled at quadratic order, and I can compute things. And in this gauge,
the brains couple to a tower of graviton and radion modes. There are also vector modes around, but they don't couple to the brain. And if I compute the potential from exchange of the graviton modes and the exchange from the exchange of the radion modes, I get exactly zero. There is a mode-by-mode cancellation from each of the modes in the graviton tower with each of the modes in the radion tower. The radion is the mode that sets the size of the space, basically. So it's here. This is what I'm calling my radion. Yeah, it's part of the full 60 multiplet. Okay, so you have this tower of graviton modes in the 4D effective theory, a tower of radion modes. They're all at the same mass, and there's an attractive potential from exchange of the radion, a repulsive potential from the exchange of the graviton, and these two exactly cancel on a mode-by-mode basis. Looks good, but how will this mechanism stand the test of compactifying and stabilizing these extra dimensions? The only way I know how to do this is the way that Freund and Rubin taught us how to do it, which is I can compactify the two extra dimensions on a spherical background with a 6D cosmological constant and a magnetic flux background. How do I get that? Oh, yeah, sorry. So because I'm stabilizing this space, that basically corresponds to giving the radion mode a mass. And so naively, what would we expect happens to our picture from before? I went the wrong way, sorry. So I'm giving the radion mode a mass, and naively I'd expect that to shift the entire radion tower, which would mean that nice cancellation that happened before mode by mode would not happen anymore. And I'd end up with some ugly potential from exchange of all the entire tower of modes of graviton and radion modes. This actually isn't what happens, and it's very surprising and very counterintuitive. So let me try and tell you about that. In order to do this, a similar calculation to what I did before in the flat x-dimensional case, now I also need to perturb the background magnetic flux. Now you might ask why this is, because my brains aren't charged on this flux. So why does putting brains on my background perturb the magnetic flux? Well, you can see it in this way. So you have some flux, total flux through my spherical background. If I put brains on it, the brains source the radion mode, which changes the size of the space. In order to conserve my flux, I also have to allow my flux to perturb in order to keep the same flux through the space. Okay, so I have to allow for a flux perturbation. If I solve Maxwell's equations, I find that my field strength looks like this. I parameterize now my metric perturbations in a slightly different way. And I need to gauge fix as before, but I also need to gauge fix the extra U1 that I have. I choose a different gauge fixing here. In this case, because of the presence of the CC and the magnetic flux, I can no longer decouple all my fields to quadratic order. So I won't be able to tell you intuitively what happens in terms of exchange of different physical modes. But what I can do is I can look at the equations of motion. I can decompose all the fields on spherical harmonics on the sphere, and I can look at the equations of motion. And the most interesting one looks like this. So it's basically a tensor spherical harmonic for a mode L, and it tells me that that this psi field, let me tell you where that came from, let me remind you, it's up here, it's basically the only field that couples to the brains. Tells me for all spherical harmonics L greater than or equal to 2, the only field that couples to the brains is actually set to 0 by the equations of motion. Okay? But for L equals 1, there is no tensor spherical harmonic, and so you get some potential. That turns out to be repulsive, and that goes like cosine theta. Now, this is really surprising from the intuition that I gave you earlier, right? Giving the radion a mass, I thought it would shift up the entire radion tower and ruin my cancellation. But it doesn't. Cancellation still occurs for all L greater than or equal to 2. It only doesn't occur for L equals 1. The only mode where the cancellation doesn't hold. This is still not great, because this gives me an eta that goes like cosine theta, and it's order one for arbitrary positions of the brains on the sphere. Because the contribution is only coming from a single mode, I can do something very simple to get rid of it, and that is I can put the brains in antipodal pairs. Okay? If I put the brains in antipodal pairs, the potential between the pair is zero. There's no gravitational potential between these pairs, because you're basically projecting out all the odd modes, all the odd spherical harmonics by doing this antipodal projection. So you get a total gravitational potential equals zero. You evade the KKLT issue that tells you every time you have a gravitational potential, you can't get a flat enough inflationary potential. But again, I've gone a little too far here, right? I've set to zero the entire inflationary potential. So where am I going to get my inflation from? Well, there's some hope. We haven't worked this out yet. There's some hope that we can get a slow roll inflation from the loop correction. But this is a very elegant, very aesthetically pleasing way to solve the problem of fine-tuning in inflation. You might be worried that I did all these things perturbatively in the brain with probe brains, and I did it perturbatively, and these results might not hold in the limit of finite tension brains, but it seems like it does, okay? So this is an argument for why I think this holds even in the limit of finite potential. If you have finite potential, you know that what the brain's doing is that it's taking a spherical space, it's cutting out the deficit. Cutting out the deficit, and it's identifying these two parts. So it's basically like the football shape of extra dimensions that Carolyn Glieker were talking about. So say I have a deficit here corresponding to one pair of antipodal brains, and I can choose my deficit however I like, right? So I have another pair of antipodal brains, and I can choose my deficit to be exactly diametrically opposite the other deficit. And so you know that everywhere else in the space, no one knows anything about the deficits. Deficits don't interact, and so the potential between these two pairs of brains has to be zero, even in the limit of finite tension brains.
If you don't put them in antipodal, you're still going to get a contribution from L equals 1 modes.
Will it be small?
Well, it goes like cosine theta, and that eta goes like cosine theta. So it doesn't work. It's not flat enough.
So are we living on one of these dots?
Well, if they annihilate, I hope not. But I guess you could live on another brain in the space. I don't know.
There's some discontinuity when I put the exactly antipodal.
Then
doesn't go smoothly to zero.
What doesn't go smoothly to zero?
The
deficit angle goes smoothly to zero as I crank the tension down.
The effect of this cosine coefficient with the cosine theta. The L equals one mods can if you put them exactly antipodal, but I have epsilon away from antipodal, the effect.
You have cosine theta, yeah. I mean you have something that goes like cosine theta at the limit of small theta. Right.
Surely, can you claim that you have less fine tuning in this picture than the usual small roll potential?
Well, this is true for arbitrary positions of the brains. I can put the brains
but
anywhere I want.
You have to say back and forward.
Sorry?
You have to separate the brains. That's fine tuning.
Why do I have to separate the brains?
Well, that's what you said.
So all that argument is not true in 2 plus 1 dimensions, in codimension 2. That was a naive Newtonian argument. This is not the case. This is basically an exceptional case, as is n equals 1.
One problem I have is that we've never observed extra dimensions, not even at the LHC. So this is a huge fine-tuning thing to put in from a physics point of view. No, you have to take this into account because it's like debit and credit at a bank, okay? You take out credit and you have to put in some payment. I mean, it's...
Extra dimensions can actually help us solve the hierarchy problem, right?
Sorry, but...
Extra dimensions can help us solve the hierarchy problem if they're large enough. It's it's a good thing. I mean, there were more than, there's more than one reason why people were interested in these kind of co-dimensional two models a while ago. Mm-hmm. There was hope that it might solve the cosmological constant problem, hierarchy, but basically all problems in one. Now we know that it's not true anymore, but I don't think that, okay, so there is, to be fair, there is one fine-tuning this problem, and that's the tuning you have to do in order to make the 4D CC equal to zero. There is one fine-tuning. But, yeah, I don't really know what to say about that. Like, I'm not worried about the hierarchy problem, I guess. I don't know.
I think this is related to Jinjo's question. I mean, is there a force? If you put these exactly antipodally, then the force, attractive force, goes to zero, I guess. But if they're not slightly antipodal, what happens? Do they evolve towards being antipodal, or does they?
So the force is actually repulsive, is what we showed. From its state to the n equals one, the force is repulsive, which tells you exactly why the antipodal position is stable. Right? Take it away from antipodal and it's going to go back to being antipodal. It's repulsive. But when you put two antipodal pairs, there's no force between them.
But the antipodal ones will still repel each other?
Yeah.
If you move them away.
If you move anything slightly away from its position of being antipodal, it's going to go back to being antipodal. This configuration is stable.
It's marginally stable or something?
Yeah.
Or it's,
actually, this is an interesting point.
What if you have them like cross, you know, which way are they going to?
They're not going to move, right? Because in antipodal pairs, they don't have any force between them. They're free to move anywhere. They don't have any force.
So then the question, I think, so suppose they were near to being antipodal but not quite. Wouldn't that be like a stall roll in place? They would slowly return to being antipodal.
Okay, so hang on. We know the potential. Is there any short here?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So the potential goes like this with beta. So the force goes like sine theta, right? So the force is only zero at theta equals pi over 2. Potential goes like this, I mean, the potential. Okay, well, let me think about it. So this force, this potential is repulsive. So at this point, the potential is zero, right? If I have one brain over here and one brain over here, the potential is zero. But the force is not zero. This is not a stable configuration. So I can't have slow rotation by expanding about this point. It's not stable. It's not a stable configuration.
I think the suggestion was expanding about the antipodal configuration.
Expand about the antipodal. The force is non-zero here, right?
No. Well, because smoothly to zero, the idea would be that
the potential is non-zero at this point.
Sure.
The potential is one at this point, so I'm not expanding. I'm not getting a single potential.
No, that's your cosmological constant problem, I suppose.
Eta goes like cosine theta. Right. Eta goes like pi double prime. My shape function double prime. I show it.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see.
Right? In order to get a small eta, I need to get a small cosine theta. And the only way I can do this is that theta plus pi over 2, which is not stable.
You're saying the second derivative of the potential is too large.
Yeah. That's the eta and epsilon. Those are the fine tuning quantities when it's set to zero. Exactly.
But you have two pairs of antipodal points.
Yes.
So suppose that they were slightly, each pair was slightly off on being antipodal.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would attract, or they would interact.
They would, yeah.
So I thought that was a suggestion for the slow roll.
Oh, no. The slow roll, so at tree level, there is zero.
That was what I was thinking. I didn't see.
At tree level, there's zero gravitational potential between these brains, but there's going to be a loop correction for that.
But the guess was that there was probably a Warren-Barton correction. It would be if you put them not exactly antipodal. You have pairs, and if it goes smoothly to zero when they're antipodal, then it should be infinitesimal if they're infinitesimally close. And
Eta doesn't go smoothly. Eta doesn't go to zero when they're on interval.
So you're saying there's a discontinuity in eta?
I don't think that's what I'm saying.
As I move them.
I think we have to be worried about two things, right? We have to be worried about stability and eta. So eta is zero when theta equals pi over 2, but this point is not stable. This is the point I would want to expand about to get a small eta. But this point is not stable. Expanding about the point that you're talking about, which is taking one slightly away from integral, is not going to give me slow roll because my eta is large now.
I think we're talking, maybe we should discuss later. I think we're talking about slightly different.
Okay, so maybe we can continue this conversation afterwards. I'd be happy to chat. There's one more thing I wanted to cover before the end of this talk. And I wanted to say that while I was completing this work, something very important happened, and that is the LHC started up. Now, this made me think a little bit about the direction that I was heading in and whether I wanted to spend the rest of my life as a physicist thinking about these big problems of naturalness and fine-tuning and how to solve them, when it seemed like there were many more urgent questions to be asked that needed answering. And as a response to that, I would like to talk about a work in progress with some people at CERN, and it started when we asked ourselves the question of whether it was possible to count the number of invisible particles in the final state of an event. Okay? Now, you're going to ask me why that's an important question. Well, particle physicists think that there's some deep connection between, or hope, maybe there's some deep connection between dark matter and new physics at the TV scale. It's a WIMP miracle. So if you just assume there's some new physics at the TV scale, coupling with the weak scale couplings, you get the right thermal relic abundance for a dark matter particle. It's known as the WIMP miracle. And how could we establish this connection on more firm footing at the LHC? Well, one way is to measure, to first look for missing energy, because invisible particles give rise to missing energy signatures at colliders. Look for missing energy. You could measure all the properties of the particle that gives rise to missing energy. You could compute relic densities from those properties, from those branching fractions and cross-sections. And you could compare with cosmological observations in order to really establish this link. But this is kind of, it's very hard to do. I don't want to say it's impossible at the LHC. It's very hard to do because for various reasons. First of all, we expect a dark matter particle, the relic abundance, to be determined by weak couplings. And by producing particles at the LHC, we're mostly probing their strong couplings. Yeah? So it's very hard to get all this information that you would require in order to really make this connection. One other way that's slightly more modest, and it can't really make that connection for you, but what it can do is can rule out that connection, and that involves counting the number of invisibles at the LHC. So if I see events with only one invisible, I can say for sure that that invisible particle is not a thermal relic that's responsible for dark matter. Yeah, that's exactly what I want to tell you.
This is why she can be inconsistent.
Explain to you in the next 5 minutes. So bear with me. Okay, so I mean, you agree, if the dark matter is singly produced, it has some couplings to the standard model, right? Because it's produced through standard model particles. So I can just reverse that process and I can compute the lifetime, and that lifetime cannot be as long as the age of the universe if it's produced at any significant rate at the LHC. Okay.
So the usual way they claim to do it is by looking at missing transverse energy when you have the collision. Missing transverse energy is things that are not invisible but potentially a new particle.
That's right.
And they have to be neutral because we don't see dark matter.
That's exactly right.
But I guess, sorry.
Okay. So how do we get this information out of LHC cross-sections? Well, if you look at, a very schematic expression for the cross-section, all the kinematic information is contained in this. It's contained in the phase space information.
So we want to extract this kinematic information, which is present in every single distribution you plot, right, in a way that's as independent as possible of the other things that we don't care about. For example, I don't care about the dynamics of the process right now. If I'm just counting invisibles, I don't want my method to be dependent on spins of intermediate particles, actual topologies, how many intermediate particles there are in my cascade decay. Those are all things that I don't care about. How do I get rid of these parameters when I look at invisibles? So one way to do this is to think of a variable that is very sensitive to just the number of invisibles and insensitive to other things in some kinematic limit. I want to try and convince you that transverse mass is one of these variables. So here's my definition of transverse mass. And you know that if I plot this this variable for an event that has a singly produced particle and missing energy, it has an endpoint at the mass of the parent particle. And you can show, just by studying the analytic form of this function, that near this endpoint, in order to be near the endpoint, all the invisible particles in the event have to be lined up in the lab frame. Okay, that's the condition. That's one of the conditions required to be near the endpoint of this MT variable. So we can compute this endpoint behavior just from pure phase space considerations, and you find that near the endpoint, this distribution of the transverse mass goes like a power law, the power law fall off. It goes like n minus 3/2, where n is the number of invisibles in the final state. So here's a proposal for how you measure the number of invisibles. If I look at this MT distribution, so this is a pure phase space simulation, pure phase space distribution for 1, 2, 3, and 4 invisibles. Now, I'm not going to argue very hard that I can tell the difference at the LHC between 3 invisibles and 4 invisibles. The fall-off is obviously faster. The more invisibles you have, the more things you have to line up in the lab frame, the harder it's going to be. So the fewer particles you're going to have near the endpoint. But I'm sure everyone will agree that I can definitely tell the difference between n equals 1 and n equals 2.
One invisible particle, which cannot be dark matter, but it decays to two other invisible particles, which can be dark matter, right? I mean, can you say, you can say presumably nothing about that, right?
One invisible particle that decays to two others,
which can very well be dark matter, right?
What can you say?
I mean, how would you say it experimentally, though? When you produce something on cell, right, that decays to a pair of them. I mean, I understand the point is that if you can say, well, this is one particle versus two, right, and then you can say...
So in
that
case, it can't be dark matter, right? Or
well, intermediate cannot be, right, but you don't know what this intermediate
does.
No,
so hang on. So if you're assuming that dark matter stabilizes on some Z2 symmetry, so... you're telling me that there's some intermediate that's not charged on the Z2 symmetry and that it decays the two dark matter particles that are charged on the number of the Z2 symmetry?
That's
the
Z2 symmetry.
Some symmetry.
But the intermediate particle is uncharged under that.
It could be charged. It's just heavier, though.
I mean, it's just heavier, right? You produce it's fragments. what I'm saying is that even if you produce a single resonance and you think, that looks like a single missing resonance, that they cannot be related to dark matter, it very well may be, because it may decay to dark matter. Right?
But if she says it's not dark matter, then she'll be right.
Right. Isn't it?
Well, this resonance would not be dark matter.
That's correct, right. Yeah, I agree.
That's right.
I need to think about that a little more. That's something
I
didn't. But, okay. So let me come back to that.
I agree that for 1 over sigma, d sigma over dx, there is this huge difference. But how does this actually look when one just looks at d sigma over dx? I mean, I would expect the total counting rate near the endpoint to go down very fast. And then there are statistical fluctuations on top of that. There are detector effects. I wonder if it will still be possible to distinguish those two cases.
I think it is definitely still possible to distinguish those cases. Let me come back to the, I don't know if I have a plot here that's going to convince you. But I don't think any of what I'm saying is very dependent on the fact. The fall off near the endpoint is definitely not dependent on the fact that I'm normalizing the cross-sections to one, right? So the fall-off behavior is going to be different. You're telling me just the number of events near the endpoint is going to change.
Exactly.
But they don't necessarily go down, right? You're telling me I have statistical issues due to the fact that I'm trying to fit these curves in regions where I have very small statistics, and that is an absolute, that's an absolute issue. Yes. That's something that needs to be worried about, but it seems from our preliminary kind of theorist level simulation that it is possible to do.
Okay.
Okay? Okay, so
I guess I'm running out of time. So let me just.
Are you looking at all the number of missing particles? I mean, what if you have a mixture of different?
So,
in order
to play this game, you need to have some rules, and that's one of the things that I'm going to be assuming. I don't know. You can say this in many different ways. You know, out of all your new physics particles, only one of them is accessible at the LHC. Something that's charged on the SU3 color. It's going to be strongly produced. And it has one dominant branching fraction. So in practice, of course, you're going to have different branching fractions. The Z3 models that we were thinking of when we started this work actually has branching fractions of 2, 3, and 4 dark matter particles. So yes, in these analyses, I'm assuming that there's one dominant branching fraction, and that's what you're seeing mostly. But the other things are going to be a background on top of the dominant one, dominant channel. Okay, so
let me just add some caveats. Fact is, at the LHC, if dark matter is stabilized by some symmetry, you expect these things to be pair produced at the LHC rather than singly produced, and for pair production, MT is not the natural variable to look at, but it's this new variable MT2, which is just a generalization of MT to pair decays. In a way, MT2 is basically invariant under back-to-back boosts of the parents, under which MT is not invariant. Okay? MT2 can be defined like this in the case where the invisible is massless, but the point about these variables is that it seems like they all have a universal fall-off near the endpoint that depends on the number of invisibles. So MT2 has exactly the same parallel fall-off near the endpoint as MT does. And so our proposal is to measure the number of invisibles by fitting the transverse mass distributions, either MT or MT2, near the endpoint. And you can get information on the dark matter stabilization symmetries and decay topologies. For example, not only can I tell you that a singly produced particle is not dark matter, but I can also tell you that if I see odd numbers of invisible particles, I can tell you that it's not a Z2 stabilization. You can forget about Z2. Okay, so there's a number of kind of important bits of information you can get just by doing the simple counting, and it seems feasible. There are some caveats. For massive invisibles, the power law fall-off is not the same, but there is a power law fall-off. It takes a different form. But you can do this measurement for massive invisibles as well. And in fact, if you fit them both, you can tell from this simple measurement whether the invisible is massive or massless. Or basically, you can get some information on the mass of the invisible particle as well. If you put in finite widths, you have an issue. Because say you look at the production of the W at the Tevatron. This is, in fact, the measurement that gives you the most accurate estimation of the W mass, measurement of the W mass of the Tevatron. Because there's one invisible, I'm telling you that the fall-off near the endpoint looks like this. It's 1 over root 1 minus x. Okay? But we know that W has a finite width, and we know the transverse mass distribution doesn't look like this anymore. All you have to do is you have to convolute this with a bright bigner that has the W width. So what this does is it gives you a tail distribution. But now, my modified proposal is, you take this function, you convolute it with a bright bigner, and you fit it and you can still extract the parameter that tells you how many individuals there are in your case. Of course, for experimenters, there's another level of complexity, which is experimental resolutions. So then you convolute this power law fall-off with a Breitbinder and a Gaussian for experimental resolutions, and you can still make the fit. Okay, and extract them from this point. I, for some reason, don't seem to have a couple of other slides that I wanted to maybe flash, which is the simulations that we did at the LHC with different, with varying spins of visible, parent, and invisible particles. So we changed, we used spin half and spin zero, we looked at all possible combinations, we looked at point-like decays, we looked at cascade decays with the intermediates on shell with varying masses, and it really seems like it is possible to extract this information, at least without looking at detector simulations or any other experimental effects.
Spins of parents. So you're assuming that it's produced out of the decays of top or doubles, or it's some new exotic particle that decays?
So we've done two cases. We've done new exotic particle decays with a number of invisibles, point-like decays, or cascades.
Some sort of a charged particle, right?
Yeah, just
which
any...
would be by itself a big deal, right?
I'm not saying that measuring... finding missing energy signatures with new physics is not a big deal.
No,
I'm saying that measuring
I'm trying, trying to,
is also
to understand.
Question.
So if it's already like you're measuring the number of missing energy particles, it's like kind of continuation, step two, right? Because you already have like step one, a new charged particle that is not
that you don't have any information about. Right? You don't have any information about. So measuring the number of invisibles tells you a number of things. It tells you how the invisibles
couple. Oh, you want to learn something about the parent particle.
You can also by looking at these transverse mass distributions. You can tell. You can find out about the mass of the parent.
Okay.
So yes, it exists, but you know, if I only see it through this channel, this is the only channel I can get information from about it from.
This is something that puzzles me. We have two protons collide at 3.5 TeV each, and you get jets, neutronic jets. And you apply energy momentum conservation, and you see a transverse energy missing in your sum.
Yeah.
So there's something new there, okay? So you eventually find out there's a particle there. Why is it a dark matter particle? Because you have to be able to establish that dark matter particle can give the halos of galaxies that produce the correct rotation curves of galaxies, for example, and the acoustical power spectrum in the CMB.
Absolutely.
How are they going to do that in LHC?
So that was my... The only way you can firmly establish that connection is actually find out all the couplings of the dark matter particles, masses of intermediates, and compute the relic density.
And it has to be stable. Obviously.
Yes, I mean, a lot of these dark matter candidates that come from new physics are stable because of some.
So how are we going to find out this stuff?
That's my point. I think it's not feasible at the LHC to make that connection. Unless you look, I can exclude, well, modulo that caveat, which I need to think about, I can exclude that connection by counting the number of invisibles. And I can tell you something about the symmetry that stabilizes it.
How are you going to do that?
If I have one invisible only, then it can't be dark matter.
There's so much talk about this in the media, the LHC, and I don't think sometimes they know what they're talking about. They don't do the cosmology and astronomy.
She's from CERN, she knows what she's talking about. Not from the media.
You appreciate this fact. The difficulties in connecting
absolutely.
The physical data
absolutely.
Where the dark matter is missing.
So right now, all it is a numerical coincidence that happens to, you know, it just happens to, it falls out of the numbers that a weak scale particle at a TeV gives you the right ballpark relic abundance.
Yeah, but
from particle physics,
we, you know, the weak scale is chosen for other reasons, so it's that's all it is right now. It's on the level of coincidence. You need much more information to make that fact solid.
The problem is that, for example, this particle in quotes 150 GeV, CdF, the Dirichlet particle for W production. Now, apparently, there have been 40 papers or more claiming all sorts of different things about what that particle is. So when they find why not? Why is it not a particle?
That's the end. So you'll say thanks for your attention.
Is there an end game? Is there an end question?
This question.
You must talk about these things at CERN. There are 3,000, 6,000 experimentalists there. So what is the consensus on my question?
I actually haven't talked to an experimentalist about it. I'm sure they are aware how difficult it's going to be to measure all the properties of dark matter at the HC. I'm absolutely sure they're aware of this.
May I make a comment on that? I think maybe it's not the right question to ask. Can we determine at the LHC alone whether this is dark matter or not? I mean, there are many other signatures of dark matter that one can look for. And for example, if one of the direct detection experiments detects something in precisely the same mass region as the LHC finds some invisible particle, I think that would already be a pretty intriguing hint. Or I don't know if the depending on the production mode in which the LHC sees the invisible particles, you might get some idea as to what the dark matter might annihilate into, and then you might look for the annihilation product in the galaxy. So maybe you can get a number of coincidences that will ultimately convince you that it's actually dark matter.
Well, of course, I think it's not so hopeless. The way things are going, Xenon 100 saw nothing, nada. Okay, they can push it to Xenon 1000 to see nothing. So you have to have a connection between the underground experiments as well. And they're not seeing anything.
Well, maybe they are seeing something. It's not clear. There's a lot of controversy surrounding those measurements.
So the future looks dark.
Is that good or bad?
I think the jury's still out on that.
Okay, well, if there are no further questions,
I did want to open this can of worms during the talk, although John tried to. But there's the question of, your first two talks were on naturalness. And so you carefully didn't tell us what it was. I won't ask you what it is, but the question. The question is, it's something like curve fitting, right? There's got to be a balance between the number of new parameters or the amount of complication that you introduce into your model against the freeing up of certain parameters from being fine-tuned. Do you think there's any quantitative way of, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you criticize your model by saying they're aesthetic,
right?
Shouldn't you include what you call the aesthetic criteria into your naturalness? And if so, then there should be some sort of quantitative Bayesian, maybe, I don't know what, but there should be some quantitative way of balancing those two against each other, if you really want to speak of some theories being more natural than some others here.
So this is the problem with the whole area, is that it's very hard to define a quantitative way, a quantitative parameter that tells you how aesthetically pleasing your model is. There are lots of definitions for naturalness out there. Not all of them agree with each other. There are some that are more quantitative than others. And this is the reason why I didn't really want to go into this issue. The fact is that the problem of naturalness has been a driving force for our field for a long time. And, you know, at least for me, that has changed since the LHC started up. And that was the point I wanted to make.
But has any thinking of naturalness of fundamental parameters in the Lagrangian has it ever led to any discoveries? That's the question. And I think the answer is no, it hasn't.
That's a good point. It's given us some nice things from a top-down perspective. Gauge coupling unification came out of naturalness. And
I mean, look, these are all theoretical concepts.
Fair enough. That's a fair point.
But think about the meson spectrum. There was some structure in the meson spectrum, and people thought about, well, we don't just want this to be tuned, like the pions having similar masses but much lighter masses than the kaons. And people came up with some arguments which in the end turned out to be true. Probably many people also came up with arguments which turned out to be wrong, but some came up with the true arguments.
I buy the arguments of naturalness when it refers to high dimensional operators like two quarks, the mu plus, mu minus, right, and where the charm was conjectured on those bases. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's one complicated.
But that's different from having, the mass of the Higgs has to be this compared to the higher scale, who knows?
So,
it's parameter is your input, right?
So
to some extent.
You're talking about the gauge hierarchy problem, right? There really is a tension there.
Yeah.
In supersymmetry, between having a Higgs mass that
too bad for supersymmetry, right?
Yeah, okay.
People would say.
Yeah, okay, I can see that point.
I forgot to say earlier that for global fits to accurate electroweak data, the best fit Higgs mass is 87 plus 26 minus 32 GeV. And then you go up in sigmas. So this is why the Higgs mass part, the Higgs mass is the line between 115 and 140 GeV.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only window left.
So the upper limit is not so robust because it comes from precision electrical.
Well, let's say I'll be generous, 200 GeV. Then you start no longer fitting the electroweak data. Okay?
Yes, but if you have any new physics, you don't have to worry about precision electroweak.
It's subject to the assumption that what you're fitting is the unmodified.
Right.
No, this.
I would say the upper limit just comes from
the minimal standard model with an isotopic Higgs, neutral Higgs. There it has to lie between 115 and 140 GeV.
Right, but we don't expect that the nature to be just the standard model.
Why not?
This is
everything
the naturalness problem, right?
Yeah, but this is okay. Well,
we expect there to be some new physics of the TV scale.
There are a lot of constraints on the Higgs mass due to Landau-Pons, triviality problems, and so on. And when you put all of this together, then it's much tighter than one. It's a tight situation. The LHC, whether they're going to be able to justify the Higgs particle or not. That's my personal opinion. Because if you don't have a Higgs particle, all of these problems go away. One can argue that there aren't any other problems left. Okay?
I think that's a good point to call the dividing line between after and